From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Education and America's Cultural Inheritance, this week on Soundings. My guests are Lynn V. Cheney, Chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities, and Charles Blitzer, Director of the National Humanities Center. Their discussion is the concluding segment in a series of four Soundings programs about the future stakes of education in America. Major funding for this series comes from the Carnegie Corporation of New York. The headlines today are filled with gloomy news about American education. Two recent bestsellers, Alan Bloom's The Closing of the American Mind and Cultural Literacy by E.D. Hirsch, Jr., indict our schools for failing to teach students how to think and for leaving them with little or no understanding of their cultural inheritance. What should American students know? How should our schools teach them to think and provide them with cultural knowledge worth thinking about? Those questions are central to American Memory, a report on the humanities in the nation's public schools, written by Lynn V. Cheney and published by the National Endowment for the Humanities. Here is Lynn V. Cheney.
I traveled across the country. I visited schools. We had experts come to Washington to talk to us about problems. There was extensive research done. But it was one day when I was at a school in the Rocky Mountains, and a curriculum supervisor was taking me around, and I was lamenting the fact that our children don't know when the Renaissance was. They don't know what the Reformation was. They can't tell you when the Civil War occurred. And she simply didn't see that this was a problem. She said, but they can always look it up. Mm-hmm. And to her way of thinking, and to the way of thinking of many educators in our schools nowadays, it's not important that the young people be taught knowledge. It's important only that they be taught how to learn. This is an idea that has corrupted education in many ways. It's important, of course, that we teach our children how to think and how to learn and how to look things up. But if we neglect the content of education, which we are clearly doing, mm-hmm. we will not teach them those mental skills, and we will also have young people who are remarkably lacking in knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Charles Blitzer, how did we get to that fix? How in the world did we arrive at the position where we are not, as much as we talk about ideas, it's mainly lip service. Help me with that.
Well, before I try to help you with that, let me just go back to the they can look it up notion.
Sure.
It seems to me one reason that talking about primary and secondary schools is so important is that this is the first chance, and in most cases the only chance, to get kids interested or even stronger and, say, excited about these things. And I can't imagine a child who has not been turned on to great literature or interested in history ever having occasion to look up the Renaissance in later life, and it seems to me that's an impoverished life. Mm-hmm. How we got into it, I'm not sure. I think it's important, though, to say something about the challenge that this society has set for itself. As Alan Bloom would say, the project, I guess, on which we're engaged. And it really is extraordinary, and it makes this a very difficult task, I think, that we hope we can undertake together here. In the first place, we're committed to educating every young person in this country to the limit of his or her ability, and that really is a revolutionary thing in the history of the world. In the second place, we're committed, and American Memory is filled with this, to the notion, which I think is a correct one, that the control of education, primary and secondary education, should be local, whether that means state or county or city or district. And in the third place, just to make it even more complicated, we're doing this in probably the most diverse society that's ever existed in the history of the world. You put all of those things together and it is a formidable task. But I think the very reasons that make it difficult are the ones that make it important. Mm-hmm. I mean, precisely because we are such a diverse society, we need some kind of glue to hold us together. And although I have to confess I have some problems with Professor Hirsch's notions of cultural literacy, I guess he calls it, nevertheless, I think there must be some things that people in this country, for want of a better word, share as a tradition. Whether they come from Southeast Asia or from Africa or from Europe.
Mm-hmm. Again, let's talk specifics. Charles Blitzer raises a number of important and interesting ideas here. Lynn Cheney, talk to me about textbooks. We understand kids don't have a sense of history because, well, the textbooks that they read, they're unhappy with them. You've made some comments in American Memory about how these textbooks are produced. Charles refers to the phenomenon of teachers who say, we'll tell you where to go look it up and not necessarily know an answer. The answers are in the textbooks, are they not?
One of the funniest things that's going on in textbooks, now funny if you have a black, dark sense of humor, is that they're trying to become totally self-contained worlds. And so we are teaching kids how to look it up, but we're teaching them in textbooks how to look it up by giving them pictures of encyclopedias. And you say to Johnny or Jane, you say, all right, you want to know about fish. Here are a picture of six encyclopedias. Which one? And the answer is A through F, of course. Which one do you look it up in? This is as opposed to taking Johnny and Jane to a library and actually having them look something up. Uh-huh. This is only the latest in a long chain of things that textbooks are doing that are really outrageous. If you look at the textbooks in the early grades, for example, the ones that we teach our children to read with, it used to be that these textbooks actually had literature in them, something that you and I would call literature.
What do they have now?
Well, now they have what I call plastic prose. It's prose. It's manufactured. It is manufactured specifically to teach a whole series of skills, such as finding the main idea, finding supporting details, practical skills sometimes, how to address an envelope, how to compile recipes. So you have this manufactured prose that's aimed at teaching these skills. It doesn't give young people any sort of notion of what literature might be, and it doesn't teach the skills that it means to teach. I remember reading one textbook, and you were supposed to be understanding character development in this one story, and it was an innocuous little story about a young fellow who traded his toys. You know, he traded this for that and that for another thing. And you were supposed to show how Johnny's trading his bouncing ball for a roller skate showed character development. You know, this is an impossible question. There was no character development in this story, and yet it was being used to show it. So the prose in these books doesn't teach the mental skills people want to teach, and it doesn't teach young people anything about literature. Mm-hmm. The social studies texts in the early grades are even more impoverished. I do not know a single good social studies textbook series for those early grades. I am convinced there isn't one.
Charles Blitzer.
Reading the passages in American Memory about textbooks, and then reading just by accident last week a study that a former fellow of the Center, Gilbert Sewell, published, which is really a kind of extended footnote to what Mrs. Cheney has to say here about textbooks. What came to my mind is that we're feeding our kids an intellectual diet of junk food, except the ironic difference is they seem to like junk food, but they don't even like this. This turns them off.
Tell me about what you call the textbook machine. The kids themselves are the victims of numerous faceless, bland committees that produce this plastic prose. That just seems to me to be an intolerable situation, and yet it goes on.
It's a difficult task. How do you decide what books to use in the schools?
I mean, this is a difficult question. You don't want to offend people, for one thing. Is that right?
Well, so what you do is you gather together a large group of people and you assign them the task of deciding what books to use in the schools. It is an incredibly complex thing they're asked to do. They're given curriculum guides, great thick manuals written in jargon that are almost impenetrable. They're given curriculum guides and told to match the textbooks up to the curriculum guides. I'm not sure this task can be done, but if it could be done, it would take several months. And people are given dozens of textbooks to review. What happens as a result is that nobody outside the schools ever actually reads textbooks. Instead, they use long checklists. They go down, are there a sufficient number of women and minorities in this textbook? Is there a good enough glossary? Is there a table of contents? Charts and graphs are very big questions. Sometimes it'll be three or four charts and graphs questions on a checklist. The questions that are really important in selecting a book that will teach a young person to love history and will give him an intellectual command of it, those questions are never asked. Instead, we're asking all these peripheral questions.
Who should be asking these questions? Why is it that they are going unanswered? Is it the school boards? Is it the parents? Is it teachers who don't know the stuff that they are supposed to teach to kids?
The answer is yes to all of the above. Uh-huh. It is a complicated matter to select textbooks. I think we would be better off if it were left in the hands of individual schools and individual school districts.
Uh-huh. Charles Blitzer.
One thing I just might add here, it seems to me in these days when we're all rightfully worried about the federal deficit, this is one whole area that really does not involve the expenditure of money. What has to happen is that attitudes have to be changed. It is a big business, and as Mrs. Cheney says in American Memory, it's really not the publishers who are at fault. They're not philanthropic enterprises. They're out there to respond to a market, and the market is giving them, in my view, all the wrong signals. But in fact, my sense is that if some of the recommendations in this document were followed, actually less money would be spent on textbooks. A lot of this stuff comes right to hand. The good literature is there, and to be really crass about it, a lot of it isn't copyrighted anymore.
That's right. That's right. That's a good point.
There it is. I was told at dinner the other night, I happened to sit next to someone from the Book Publishers Association who was rather defensive about this, and I sympathized with him, because it is not the publishers who are insisting on foisting these things on a market that doesn't want them. They are responding to the market. Mm-hmm. It's big business. If I remember his figures correctly, it's about $1.5 billion a year that this country spends on textbooks. Although, to put that in perspective, that, he said, is about a third what the country spends on cat and dog food in a given year.
But you're absolutely right. It's a problem where we don't need more money. In fact, we would probably be better off if we were spending
less. Exactly.
I think that one great change we could make tomorrow in the schools would be if every school would quit buying social studies texts in the first, second, and third grade. I've never seen a good one. And we're spending millions of dollars buying inferior material for our children. We could use original texts for this instead of using textbooks.
Much as kids do in colleges and universities.
It does. It's going to require some retraining of teachers. It's very hard for a teacher who has many, many things to do to learn to rely upon individual real books instead of one large textbook.
Charles Blitzer.
I just want to interject. I don't know if I'm chiding Mrs. Cheney or not, but she seems to have been captured by this notion of social studies, too.
Oh, I despise it.
I think it should be
clear. Wish we could do away with that word.
Yeah, it should
words.
Be clear to the people who haven't read this that social studies is a kind of monster that has swallowed up what used to be history and several other perfectly respectable disciplines.
What does it consist of? Economics, and it's a melange.
How to mail a letter.
Driver's education, yeah, marriage and family, values clarification, sex education. It means all of those things. And because it means all of those things,
it means nothing.
But as every new fad comes along and it's brought into the schools under the rubric of social studies, history is driven further and further to the edge and finally out of the curriculum.
Mm-hmm. Lynn Cheney, Charles Blitzer, we're talking about American Memory, a report on the humanities in the nation's public schools. I asked you earlier to help me pin down the culprit here. I don't want to get into name-calling, and I don't want to get into a lot of hostility, but can we point the finger at the educationists, at the schools of education that have produced our teachers? We have, what, a diverse responsibility, I understand. Charles?
Well, let me say, since I'm not a public official subject to the scrutiny, Mrs. Cheney is, I would say, yeah, to a very large extent, I think one can. Mm-hmm. I think it is, more than anything else, the professional educators, in quotation marks, and the schools of education, that for whatever reasons, and I'm prepared to admit their motivations were the best possible ones, I don't know what they were exactly, but I think more than any other group, they are the ones who are responsible for all the things we've been talking about.
Well, rather than berating them, rather than, you know, singling out the errors, what do we do? What
I'd like to backtrack for a second. I think that it is indeed true that there are many flaws in the ways that we have prepared our teachers, and that colleges of education have gone about preparing them, asking them to take many, many hours of courses that teachers themselves say are not useful, that there is no evidence showing that these courses make better teachers. That is true. And I will also say that enlightened colleges of education are beginning to move away from this, are looking for ways to work with arts and science faculties so that we can restore content to teacher training. That's been the problem with it. It has been all process and no content. Even as I say those things about colleges of education, though, and I wonder if Charles will not agree with this, it is also true that humanities faculties have been remiss. They have not been interested in teacher preparation for our schools. And in fact, the one piece of research that strikes me on this subject shows that teachers teach the way they were taught. And by failing not only to emphasize teacher preparation for our schools, but by failing to place much of a premium on fine teaching in our colleges and universities, humanities faculties have also got some responsibility to bear for where things have gone awry.
Charles Blitzer, you run the National Humanities Center. You hang around with 40 scholars every year. Is Lynn Cheney on the on the mark here?
Well, I would say that I taught for a number of years in what I guess one would describe as an elite institution, or in fact a couple of elite institutions, and this goes back longer than I care to remember. And faculty there, including me, were complaining about the kinds of students that turned up in September as freshmen and the bad education that they were getting. This is not a new phenomenon by any means. Mm-hmm. But in retrospect, and reading American Memory really brought this home to me, it really, I have to say, never occurred to me or to most of us that we should be doing something about this. We complained that the high schools were sending us ill-prepared students, and then we kind of threw our hands up and said, that's the way it has to be. I think there is a change. I think the National Endowment, among others, has been a great help. And if I can put in a plug for the National Humanities Center, with the help of the endowment as well as three private foundations, we have been running three-week high school teacher seminars each summer. And much as I love what goes on around here for the other 9 months of the year, in some ways that's the most satisfying thing I think that happens here. Mm-hmm. Partly not for ideological or philosophical reasons, but because we recognize that we don't know anything about this other approach to education and curriculum planning and curricular units and behavioral objectives and all of that. We take precisely the approach you're suggesting.
I should also point out that what we frequently hear at the endowment from people who have participated in this program, from the directors, for example, the college and university faculty who direct the seminars or the institutes, is that somehow their own research has been shaped by this experience. The teachers are not only good students, they are teachers, and the faculty members who direct these efforts learn from them, gain new insights into their work, see possibilities for fresh approaches. So It is a very collegial atmosphere that occurs in these seminars and institutes, and I think that's one of the reasons why it's so valuable.
Lynn Cheney and Charles Blitzer were talking about American Memory, a report on the humanities in the nation's secondary schools. We've been talking about teachers and about students. At one point in American Memory, Mrs. Cheney, you talk about the Carnegie Report on teaching as a profession. You seem to agree with that. That's a noble goal. How is that going to happen, that we separate the teacher preparation from the teacher certification in order to get back to more substantive kinds of things in our schools?
The idea is to set up a board that will provide a nationwide certification that will give teachers a national sort of stamp of approval. Uh-huh. Right now, the Carnegie Forum on Education and the Economy is working on a series of tests that will not only be able to test for knowledge of a subject area, but that will be able to test teaching skill. It's going to be very difficult to come up with a series of tests that can test for teaching skill that aren't somehow as silly as much as what has already gone on in education is. It can be done, I think, particularly if it has a very pragmatic and practical orientation. It will be difficult. But by setting up this nationwide standard for certification, what Carnegie can do is help unlink the certification and the licensure process for teachers from colleges of education. If you can go to the Carnegie place, wherever it will be, and take these exams and gain a certification that will be recognized, one hopes, in numbers of states and localities, then becoming a teacher will not depend upon seat time in a college of education. Right. It will depend upon this demonstrated ability. There are all sorts of problems involved. One problem involved right now has to do with the NEA, which is demanding a certain number of seats on the board overseeing the test making process, and finally a number of seats on the certification board itself. I certainly think teachers should be the most represented group on this, but the NEA is suggesting it not only wants to have its quota of seats, but that anyone who occupies one of those seats will have to undergo a training program through the NEA. This is very problematic in many ways, partly because one worries that that the motive of the union may be directed not toward letting more and more people into the profession, but toward restricting entry, toward saying, for example, that nobody can take these tests until they've gone through a college of education, which would, you know, entirely
back into the same
exactly,
spiral.
Exactly, do away. So it's very very, very difficult to get from where we are now to where Carnegie hopes to be, but I mm-hmm. think we should give them all the support we can.
What is your sense about the parents? We've talked about the education people and about the kids. Do the parents really care? You both speak from the perspective of individuals who run institutions where you're frequently in touch with the professoriate. And we're passionate in our beliefs and opinions about American education. What about the parents themselves? Is that too far removed? Is that too abstract for you to have a sense of response to the recommendations that you're making in American Memory?
Most of the letters we received have, in fact, been from teachers. But we have received so many letters. The response to American Memory has been so overwhelming that I think you can say there is a general worry in the population at large about mm-hmm. our schools, a concern about our schools, a real desire to make them better. I recently had two of my children finish up in public school systems. I was a concerned parent. I think what concerned parents, and I hold myself up as an example, have not done in the past is really looked at the content of education. I never read a textbook while my children were in school. I mean, I can excuse myself. They're dreadful to read. It's a boring experience. Yeah. But I should have read one so that I understood what my own children were going through. Parents, I think, who are concerned, and I think there are many of them, can do their children and education itself a great favor by looking very closely at the content of education and suggesting remedies for their schools.
Mm-hmm. Let's conclude our conversation, Lynn Cheney and Charles Blitzer, and approach the conclusion by way of some of these recommendations that you have made at the end of American Memory. More time devoted to the study of history, literature, and foreign languages. Textbooks becoming more substantive. Teachers being given the opportunity to become more knowledgeable about the subjects that they teach. Wonderful blue sky goals that I think everybody would agree about in some fashion or another, and yet they're going to be very, very difficult to implement. Have I got this right?
It will take persistence. This is not a subject that you can make a single pronouncement on and then hope that tomorrow all will be well. It mm-hmm. will take persistence. Looking at the content of education, which is what American Memory does, is very difficult, and getting changes in that content. I'm using every opportunity I can to speak to groups who really can make a difference. School board members, school administrators, parents, teachers. So you're right. It is a long and difficult task. The major goal that American Memory had, at least the goal that was in my mind when I was writing it, is that first, before any of these changes can be effected, we have to get humanities education on the reform agenda. As you know, we've been through a period of educational reform now that really began about 1983, and there's been a lot of concern about our schools, but it's been directed toward math education, mathematics, science, basic skills. Not toward history and literature, toward foreign language some, but not toward history and literature. Mm-hmm. Main goal of American Memory was to set forth a case why history and literature are important to our children, to get those subjects on the reform agenda. Now, you're right, having accomplished that, and I think we have accomplished that, we do have ahead of us a very arduous task, and that's bringing about the changes that are necessary.
Charles, how about from the standpoint of the professoriate? These are the people that you deal with frequently. Are these goals realistic? Are they receiving what? The endorsement, the help, the support of...
I go back to your first statement of the question to Mrs. Cheney when you say recommendations everyone can agree to.
Yeah.
I wish that were so. I have a feeling if we were starting from scratch with no educational system, perhaps, and trying to design one.
Uh-huh. So they are not agreeing to this.
There are a lot of vested interests here,
yeah.
Unfortunately. There's a lot at stake politically and economically for a lot of people who were, by no fault of their own, perhaps, raised in an earlier system. And it's a big job, I think. I think the way to do it, and this is clearly an enormous contribution to it, is to change attitudes. You can't do this simply by passing laws. Washington, because of our decentralized education system, simply cannot ordain, as the French do, that every student on mm-hmm. a given day will be reading the same chapter of the same book that is approved by a lot of professors in Paris. But I do think, if, as has been said, the way to solve a problem first is to recognize that it exists, that we've got a good start with that, and I think that American Memory is an enormous contribution to that, and specifically our own experience here on a very small scale, and what I've read about the experience of others on a larger scale, does suggest that the professoriate, as you call it, or the people who have to deal with the products of this educational system, products who I think are really being robbed of their heritage. Someone said, and it's quoted in here, I think, that if a foreign power conquered us and wanted really to destroy the moral fiber, the identity of this society, mm-hmm. they would try to impose upon us what somehow we have fallen into imposing upon ourselves. I think that is being recognized by professors. I think there is a long, long way to go, but I think the recognition of the problem, and I think it now is recognized in the academy, and if it can be recognized throughout the country by the people who make the decisions, is at least possible. It's not going to be easy. And thank God for people like Lynn Cheney who are doing something about it.
Lynn Cheney, what one thought, what one piece of advice would you give to a parent or a teacher or a student listening to this discussion about what you have termed American memory?
Let me phrase the question a little differently. The problems are so great, they are so complex, they are so multiple, that I think it's easy to become discouraged and to say, everything's wrong. Textbooks are terrible, the curriculum is awful, the teachers aren't trained properly, we just can't do anything, and throw up your hands and walk away from it. It does seem to me there is an entry point, one area which we can concentrate on that has the possibility of affecting change in all areas, and that's with teacher preparation and with the intellectual sustenance of our teachers. As one very good teacher said to me, if you get enough good people in the schools, that is, if you make training programs attractive instead of intellectually demeaning, if you can attract good people into teaching, and if you can make being there a reward professionally, you get enough good people in the schools, we'll change it. We won't use inadequate textbooks. We'll use real books. We'll see that whatever textbooks we use are good. We will see that the curriculum is good, whatever the curriculum guide might say. So I do think that by concentrating on teachers and on reforming the ways that teachers are trained and sustained, that by taking that relatively simple task, though it's difficult enough in itself, that we can hope to reform, to change our schools.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to the concluding segment in a series of four discussions about the future stakes of education in the United States. My guests were Lynn V. Cheney, Chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities, and Charles Blitzer, Director of the National Humanities Center. The Carnegie Corporation of New York provided major funding for this series. The views expressed are the participants' own and are not necessarily those of the Carnegie Corporation of New York. For a cassette copy of Soundings on America's Cultural Inheritance and of American Memory, a report on the humanities in the nation's public schools, send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Ask for program number 400. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
The headlines tell us that American education is in serious trouble, and many studies indict our schools for failing to teach students how to think and what to think about. What should American students know? This week on Soundings, the chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities and the director of the National Humanities Center discuss the liberal arts in American schools. The humanities and public education. Some answers and insights this week on Soundings.